What would happen if Trump today was tempted to say, I'm going to do my own Desert Storm and I'm going to move a bunch of troops over there? Can we do that?
No, first of all, we live in a new world today, and you could never build a lodgment unless you had enormous quantities of air and missile defense that you could surround the so-called lodgment area where you would collect and organize and assemble forces. And at the time, you know, one of the things that we discussed privately was if we ever have to come back again in the future, given the direction of technology, we'd probably have to land at a place like Yanbu on the Red Sea and then cross the desert. Because if we tried to get into the Persian Gulf, we would be sunk or attacked or killed pretty rapidly. A lot of people realized, you know, I think more people realized the danger that would be presented in the future than we appreciate right now. Admiral Zabrowski certainly understood that, as did the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, whose name escapes me at the moment. But there were people that were thinking this through. But ultimately, Dan, I think the real lesson is this. Even though there were smart people at the helm, nothing really changed inside the force.
And, you know, you talk about if we land in Yanbu, which is about right there on the map there, that would be 1,000 kilometers that we would have to travel just to get to the battle space area right there, as opposed to when you and I went in, we went to Al Jubail, which was right here. That would be literally impossible right now with all of the Iranian firepower that they have all up and down this coast for us to try and disembark with ro-ro ships and container ships to get our tanks and whatever else off the board here just to drive up to Kuwait. That would be nearly impossible right now. In fact, it might be absolutely impossible. What do you think?
Completely, without question. No doubt about it. And, you know, the tanks are still equipped with these turbine engines. And those things, as you know, drank fuel. And even though you have this auxiliary power unit that's supposed to reduce the amount of fuel that you consume, if you're moving, it doesn't make any difference how fast you move. You consume the gas at roughly, I think it was what, 8 hours, 7.5 to 8 hours, and you're on empty. I mean, that's 7 or 8 hours of operation. You can't fight a war that way. That's why the notion of committing these forces in a place like Ukraine is absurd. Ukraine is enormous. You'd go a couple of 100 miles and everybody's standing around waiting for tons of fuel to arrive. It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. And in fact, it doesn't. Whether it makes sense or not, we just don't have that capability anymore. So if that happens, the whole system is so much more vulnerable than it was in 1991. It's remarkable how less capable we are today. And I don't think President Trump keeps saying, and Secretary Hegseth said 2 days ago, repeated, we're the most powerful military on the planet. And yet we couldn't even do a Desert Storm 2 because of our limited capability. That's the reality of it.
Well, Dan, you got an echo? You got an echo? Okay.
I don't hear an echo. If you do, I'm not sure about that.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you fine. I have no problem hearing you.
Yeah, I think we have to understand that it's civilians in general, particularly people who are members of Congress, you know, they're very impressed with glitz and glamour, shock and awe. You show them videotapes of explosions. They equate an explosion on the ground with an effect that is a war-winning effect. There's no understanding of how complex warfare is. And the need for multiple capabilities being employed and orchestrated as an integrated force. There's just no understanding of that at all. So everybody is in the hunt for a silver bullet. Everybody wants to buy the silver bullet that will win the war. And we're finding out that there are no silver bullets unless you want to go the nuclear route. And we should talk about that because I think that's being discussed too.
And, you know, let's take a look there, Doug, because you say it's complex. Well, apparently for most in Washington, it's actually not complex at all. It's kind of easy. It's just about a bunch of cash. And here we have a $1.5 trillion defense budget was passed by the House, and that was a little bit deceptive. We're going to talk about what the internal parts of that are here shortly. But just looking at the top line number here, $1.15 trillion, but that's also in addition to $350 billion, of which it was just for semantics, so it didn't look as $1.5 trillion, going from $1 to $1.5 trillion, which is just astronomical. But Congress is really happy with that. And also, turns out that that is that money equals capability. And General Jack Keane says, you know what? Let's just go and use that force and finish the job.
We are on a definite path to return to major combat operations that would involve Israel and the United States. I think that is the path we're on. Is there some negotiations that the Iranians want to do here? Of course, they want to negotiate. Why now? They want to negotiate because they want to stop the United States from imposing their will by firing on them and taking away their military capabilities. They want to stop that, as they did successfully back on April the 7th and April the 8th. They want to replay that. I don't believe that's going to happen. Pakistanis and Qataris are supporting him on that, but I don't think that's where the president is and his team around him. I believe where they are frustrated, they want to get the Straits of Hormuz eventually open and also return to major combat operations and finish what they started out to do in terms of assigned military objectives.
So that's all we got to do, Doug. Just got to go and finish the job here. What say you?
Well, he said some very important things that the audience needs to note. First of all, he led off his discussion with Israel. Dan, this entire war is about Israel and the interest of its agents in the United States, its lobby, its supporters, the Zionist billionaires, whatever you want to call them. That's what this is about. This is not about the United States of America. Contrary to popular belief, Iran is not and never has been an existential threat to us. And if you go back and pick through all the series of supposedly horrific things the Iranians have done to us, they all shrink to insignificance next to the war that we encouraged Iraq to fight against Iran that cost Iranians somewhere between 500,000 and 700,000 dead and perhaps a million casualties. Nobody brings it up. We set it up. We equipped Saddam Hussein. We sent him into action. This is long before we went after Saddam. And this is a big problem. This is not about our interests. We have no interest in attacking Iran. Remember, it was the attack on Iran by the United States and Israel that has caused the Gulf to be closed. It was open until we attacked. Now, suddenly, everything that we talked about in the past, the nuclear development and capability and bringing, you know, Iran to the table and all this kind of nonsense, that's all taking a back seat to control of the Persian Gulf. That's where we are, and that's what we're focused on. And until that resolves itself, we're not going to move on to very much else. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not interested in destroying whatever infrastructure is out there that supports the One Belt, One Road. These are the Chinese rail lines and so forth, the connectivity to Russia, because Iran has a very important role to play in the One Belt, One Road that China has started. But having said that, this is really preeminently, first and foremost, about Israel. And Americans just have to get that through their heads because they ought to be asking why. And, you know, you flashed across this defense bill. And in the new defense authorization bill, there is this integration of Israeli force, let's call it force development or technological development, and American technological development in a purely military context. And I think Larry Wilkerson said it best. I think it was early this morning or could have been yesterday afternoon. He said, what we're doing is that we're making what Pollard, the Israeli spy who ratted us out to all sorts of people, legal. In other words, what he did, for which he was sentenced to life imprisonment, is effectively being legitimated and legalized by this defense authorization bill. Americans ought to be very concerned about that. And I don't think most Americans even appreciate what it means.
Yeah, I'm very sure that a lot of them don't. I mean, that's many are starting to. Thomas Massie, of course, led the charge to try and from within to try to get this thing stripped out. He obviously failed because 100%, I believe it was nearly 100% of the Republicans were supportive of that bill in the House of Representatives, and about half of the Democrats were. So there's still an overwhelming number of people who were still subservient to whatever the Israeli side, no matter what they're talking about with the intelligence and the military tying together of the two sides. And I just wonder if you can just on a practical level, just talk about that for a second, because we have had, you know, this claim that, oh, we gain a lot from Israel. We have had other good allies too since World War II, Great Britain, France, Japan, Germany, UK, obviously. And yet we have never even contemplated joining our militaries to them, no matter how good our relationship has been. Why? I mean, this is probably a loaded question, but why do you suppose we're talking about doing that with this tiny little country of Israel when we won't do that to our advantage potentially with any of these other allies?
Well, the other allies have not invested billions of dollars in the campaigns of members of the House and the Senate. In other words, people in the House and the Senate stand to benefit directly and indirectly from these arrangements. It's effectively, on one hand, they're benefiting because they get money from the Zionist billionaires representing the Israeli lobby. And they're also going to be rewarded for supporting the Israeli lobby in the form of kickbacks that are funneled back through their districts and states and so forth. So the financial dimension is unambiguous. It's very real. Again, we're just legislating and legitimating treason for all intents and purposes. We're saying this is all right. Now, why would they do that? Because most of them don't think it matters. They don't trace anything. They don't care about it. They need to understand the Israelis are certainly not above and have done so in the past, selling our technology to the Chinese or the Russians or to any number of other people for the right price. So the Israelis are very, let us say, open-minded about any technology that they receive from us. We don't seem to care about that because we just don't think it matters. It won't have any impact on us. And they're wrong. And what we don't seem to understand is that technologies that were once a monopoly of American military power are now widespread and proliferating, in part because of Israel and other states. So this is not the time to be careless. But money has a special meaning. Greed is endless. Washington, I sometimes describe it as this enormous mountain-like feature that is entirely composed of cash. And people come here to dig into the mountain, fill up every wheelbarrow and bag they can with as much cash as possible before they quit and go home again.
Well, that's an interesting analogy. We're talking about all these mountains that we can't penetrate with missiles in Iran, and there's this cash mountain we also regular people can't penetrate either. We'll see where that goes. But you said people aren't talking about this. At least one person is talking about it a lot, and that is Tucker Carlson.
The entire House of Representatives, every Republican but seven today, minutes ago, just voted to merge the U.S. military, the $1.5 trillion a year U.S. military with the tiny reserve force IDF. Does that help us? No, of course it helps them. Merge American intelligence, the 19 intel agencies, with Mossad. What? Of course. Basically a humiliation ritual. Whatever you want, Israel. If it hurts us, that's fine. Actually, it feels good to sacrifice for you. It's like everyone in the entire government is Mike Huckabee now.
Wow, that last part there. Everyone's Mike. Hard to argue with that because Mike Huckabee on paper is the U.S. ambassador to Israel, but definitely he is the Israeli mouthpiece to America, no matter what his title is. Hard to argue with much Tucker said there.
No, I think Tucker's essentially correct. The difference, of course, is that Tucker has 24-hour-a-day security to protect him, and he needs it. That's how dangerous it is for him to speak publicly and say these things. That doesn't mean it isn't risky for others, but we don't have that kind of security. The interesting part is that none of this had to be this way. During World War II, we were very sensitive to the information, the intelligence, and the things that we gave to the British. In fact, sadly, FDR was much more ready to support the communists in the Soviet Union, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union that was fighting the West at that time, Hitler. And before Hitler, it was prepared to fight us as well, obviously. As a result, people subsequently after World War II, when they discovered these things, I mean, they discovered, for instance, that in January of 1945, we shipped a very large portion of plutonium, enriched uranium, to the Soviet Union. And this is something that FDR authorized through Harry Hopkins. People couldn't believe it, but it happened. It should never have happened, but he signed off on it. We did nothing like that for the British under any circumstances. So this is not the first time, but it's not going to be advantageous for us. It will redound to our disadvantage. And I just can't even begin to imagine how bad it can get. Right now, things are bad enough with this pointless, unnecessary war against Iran.
Well, and that's actually, I want to jump back to that, because there are some continuing developments even today. We talked just a second ago that because of what has happened in the Bab al-Mandab in the Red Sea, that and the Houthi attack of a couple of ships yesterday caused the price to go back up to over $100 a barrel. That's the paper price, though. But let's show you the actual practical impact at the point. This is live right here. This is the spot price for oil. This is what, when anybody fills up a tanker and they buy a physical barrel of oil, not the paper, this is what it's trading at right now, $140 a barrel. And that's what has the impact on our our economy, because economic activity is based on the amount of energy you have. And so when you have to pay that much for energy, then the commensurate price of your economic output will also rise. It's not the $100 barrel, as bad as that is. It's $140, which can only go up. What concerns do you have about what impact that's going to have on our economy as we, especially if Jack Keane's advice is taken there and we end up going back to full-scale operations?
Well, you're talking about the difference between the paper price and the real price, and it's very important, and you're right. I said earlier that it's going to go to $150 within the next 30 days or so. I'm talking about the gap between the two is going to narrow. One is going to catch up with the other. And when that catches up, it has a huge impact. Not only is no one interested in buying our debt at this point, and that's a big problem because that's part of the system that backs the petrodollar. In addition to that, we're going to see these treasury interest rates rise. When that 10-year hits 5%, all you have to do is run the numbers, run the math. We cannot service the debt. The debt, remember, is already as large as the defense budget. In other words, the payments, it's going to go well beyond that. I think there's something else, too, that people don't understand. When you have cheap energy, you also usually have cheap credit. Now, cheap credit means that you're paying very little for new money. Right now, that's drying up quickly. As your position weakens financially, the cheap credit dries up. When you can't get cheap credit, you can't afford real credit. My point is that could crash the entire economy. Our whole financial system could collapse. And in the meantime, remember that you have China, which is moving to gold-backed currency. They haven't announced it in those terms, but that's effectively where they're headed right now. That's why they opened the vaults in Riyadh and the vault in Hong Kong. That's why they want to enable countries to pay for their oil and energy and anything else they want in gold. And everybody is now turning slowly but surely, consistently, towards the yuan because it has value. What does that say about the dollar? They're de-dollarizing. They're walking away from the dollar because the dollar doesn't appear in their minds to have long-term stability in terms of value.
And the all of this is going to be exacerbated because you're talking about these economic costs that are starting to manifest. Now it's not theoretical. It's starting to happen right before our eyes at the time that Jack Keane is wanting to go down the path that caused all of these problems to rise up where we are. He wants to double down on those. Well, let's take a look at what that's going to mean, because first of all, the Strait of Hormuz, even though the United States Central Command lies every day and saying that the Strait of Hormuz is open, we have very practical, concrete evidence that that's a complete lie. No, hardly anything is traveling through the Hormuz, especially on our path here. More concerning, especially if we go back into these strikes here, is on our Patriot expenditures. So we see that the Iranian side, despite all of our vaunted Patriot and THAAD air defense systems, whatever, most of the shots are getting through, and they are precise hits by the Iranian side. Then when you look at those, this is really important here. This is going to tail into something you published recently. America is firing Patriot interceptors at more than 100 times faster than we can build them. 11 straight nights of American strikes, now 12, and Iranian missile drones still reach Kuwait, Bahrain, and Jordan. U.S. intelligence assessment reported by the Washington Post concluded that the bombing is unlikely to move Tehran at all. And then the underlying math is what matters. During the first 4 days of this war, coalition forces expended Patriot rounds at roughly 225 per day, while Lockheed's facility produces 1.7, a consumption ratio of 132-1. And that immediately made me think of this piece that you've recently published on your Substack, Trump's War to the Last Missile. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about what that reveals based on some of the information we just posted?
Well, when I wrote this, I wrote it to get the point across to people that we could run out of missiles long before Iran does. In fact, we could end up not being able to provide any of our strategic partners or friends any missiles at all. We're already stripping out much of the world's missile inventories and shipping them to the Middle East. This is not going to end well for us. We're simply going to look impotent in the eyes of the world. And if you admit that your bombing strategy or your air and missile strategy isn't working, that you're not hitting the right targets, which is always the essence of the promise of success for air and missile campaigns, well, then it suggests that you're nearing the end of your inventory. And what do you do when you have no more missiles to fire? Harry Kazianis wrote a great piece where he tried to explain this. Now, when back in the early at 2001, 2, 3, and 4, before I left the Army, I must tell you that there were people in Raytheon, in Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, who were making the argument in private that they cannot surge. Now, during World War II, everybody says, well, look what we did during World War II. Well, the government poured in billions of dollars to help somebody like Henry Ford build this mile-long assembly line so that we could turn out thousands of aircraft very, very rapidly, and they perfected it, and they did it. We haven't had anything like that occur. In other words, there has been no focused investment to get the kind of surge capacity that you need if you fight. Now, the Russians realized they were in a difficult position back in 2022 when they moved into Ukraine, and they discovered, my God, this force is much larger and more dangerous than even we thought. And then they captured the plans and saw that they wanted to use that force against them in a place like Crimea, not just in Donetsk, Luhansk, and so forth. So what did they do? They focused their investment, they focused their attention, their manpower, everything on the scientific industrial base so that they could rapidly turn out the weapons and the missiles they need. And, you know, Alex Vershinin has written about this, about the criticality of an industrial base if you're going to fight an industrial war. And we're involved in an industrial war. But what we lost sight of was that it's a war of missiles and unmanned systems, specifically these relatively inexpensive Shahad drones and others. That's a little different from what we anticipated. We have satellites. We can build a similar ISR strike capability, but we don't have the vast numbers of missiles and drones that we need. But we do have a lot of other things. Unfortunately, a lot of the other things that we have aren't terribly useful. So this is not news, but it's a reality that we have to deal with. The smart thing to have done when we realized we were in this position was to get out of this and go home and get back on the drawing board, re-examine what we were doing, what we would need. But we didn't do that. Instead, we're doubling down on failure. And so you're going to get a double failure. You're going to get failure militarily, strategically in the Persian Gulf against Iran, matched by strategic failure at home, financially, economically. I can't think of a worse set of circumstances for any great power in the history of mankind.
You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.